podcast this week. It is Valentine's Day and love is in the air. And as a result, I've got you all a gift, listeners. Emerald Fennell, director of, open quotes, Wuthering Heights, close quotes. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is standing in front of three colleagues of such lethal cunning, asking them to love me. Luckily, we also have Marjorie from HR on standby just to make sure that everything is above board. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, the three colleagues of such lethal cunning who are sitting in front of me in the pod booth are Geek Queen Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Empress of the Dark, Becky Dark.
Hello.
And what is James Dyer's nickname this week? I liked James Roger Legend stumbled upon last week. It's very apropos for Valentine's Day, wouldn't you say, Jimbo?
It would be if indeed today were Valentine's Day. Or are you just assuming that you won't get the podcast edited until Saturday?
It's Valentine's Day weekend.
I mean, that's not a thing.
It is a thing.
Wow. It's not a thing.
Somebody's salty
one day.
About Valentine's.
Helen had a Valentine's Day dinner just the other day with her husband.
Did you really?
I did, yeah. We went early.
Like a full week in advance?
No, like 3 days in advance.
To beat the crowds.
Yes, it saves you from paying double.
Essentially that.
Nando's are the same price all year round.
Lovely stuff. All right, so James Dyer is here. If you've been listening to the show over the last few weeks, James's nickname, the Camino Kid, has been rejected violently.
Never my nickname.
For the year 2026. And we have turned to you, the listeners, for nickname suggestions for James. I call him Jimbo, but we want to come up with a new official nickname because he's not happy with Camino Kid. and we have a number of suggestions, but the one I've gone for this week, Jimbo, is Thus. And this comes
thus.
From...
Yes, that's a terrible
simply,
nickname.
Simply Thus. This is absolutely fucking deranged. This is from Tony Yee on Instagram, Berets for Breakfast, who says, long story short, I've just read this for the first time properly. I had a pint with the Watcher who revealed that... James Dyer, there are other multiversal James Dyer variants who have nicknames. From Earth Q47, James Quag Dyer, right?
Okay.
He is an uber nerd who creates chaos and complicates any environment by correcting people on sci-fi and fantasy facts or by loudly insisting that Molly's Game is a 4-star film.
Doesn't ring a bell.
In this multiverse, James Quag Dyer, is married, apparently, to Aaron Sorkin.
Oh. Interesting.
Do you like that?
I hear he's a very conscientious lover.
You think?
Quag.
All right, good stuff. So, James Quag Dyer.
No.
On Earth... don't worry, there's only one more.
Okay.
On Earth, there is James Duke Diarrhea.
Right.
Whose original name was James Rhea Dyer V. He first appeared on Tales of the TV Pilot podcast.
This is absolutely incomprehensible.
He's given origin stories and backstories to all of these multiversal James Dyers.
How considerate.
James Dyer, origin and powers. He arrived on Earth as a baby with a birth certificate reading James Rhea Dyer V. He later claimed he was a fifth-generation duke and a missing royal aristocrat. Tony, what are you doing, man? You've taken valuable minutes of your life to write this. I'm very happy that you've done it, but honestly, think of what you could have done. You could have climbed a mountain.
This is screaming D&D Games Master.
It really is, isn't it? So a TV pilot podcast, not the pilot TV podcast, but a TV pilot podcast review of Who Do You Think You Are revealed that the fee wasn't a Roman numeral, but instead stood for Ferbal. So his true identity is James Ferbal Diarrhea, or Duke Diarrhea for short. His powers, he promotes his podcast at every possible opportunity with unstoppable enthusiasm, and his power cry of June causes crowds to flee in the opposite direction. So there you go.
I'm just saying, it would have taken you like 2 minutes to pre-read and triage these things before we recorded the podcast, but could you be fucked? No.
Yeah, but the trouble is you immediately discounted Quag, and so now you are...
I'm saying, saddled with diarrhea. If we don't get a good one soon, I'm just going to pick my own.
You can't pick your own game.
Like Arnold Rimmer, I am going to choose my own nickname.
How did that work out for Rimmer?
Brilliantly. Yeah. Please, that's Ace Rimmer to you.
Well, yeah. Ace is a different matter. Anyway.
All right. is James a diarrhea or is he a Rimmer? We'll find out in due course. Have you rejected finally both of these nicknames?
Shockingly, yes.
The search goes on. All right.
So unreasonable.
If you have a nickname that you would like to be bestowed upon Jimbo on a permanent basis, no going back on this nickname. Once we choose one that fits, we'll know it when we hear it, right? Because we'll look at him and we'll go, that's him. That's him. Yes. Then please send him in. You find me on any social platform that you care to mention. And slide into my DMs. Let me know what you think Jimbo's nickname should be. But anyway, hello. Welcome, everybody. How are you? Becky, welcome back to the regular podcast. It's been a while. It's been a minute.
It's me, Becky. Come home now. Here I am. Thank you for having me back.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Of course, this weekend doesn't just have Valentine's Day in it. You know, as a horror nut, as part of the evolution of horror, you must be celebrating Jason Voorhees' birthday as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Always.
Which is today, Friday the 13th, as people listen to this, or yesterday if you were listening to this on Saturday.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I've already rewatched part 3 this year. And I have such a smorgasbord to pick from for what I'll be watching later today on Friday the 13th.
Oh, very good. What's your favourite Friday the 13th movie?
Great question, thanks for asking. Okay. Probably 4, Final Chapter.
Yeah, strong, confident, powerful.
There's a really special place in my heart for X because I really love it when he goes to space.
Who doesn't? We now call it Jason Twitter. As revenge.
I see what you did
there. Oh my God, we should do that with all things called X.
Fast Twitter.
Fast Twitter.
Fast Twitter. Exactly.
Twitter.
Triple Twitter.
This works. I think this works.
Jason X. It's
got one of the best kills.
The liquid nitrogen one?
Yeah, the liquid nitrogen kill.
Yeah, but the rest of the movie is...
David Cronenberg's in it.
David Cronenberg's in a lot of shit. with me right now. I'm so angry with him. No, he makes some bad choices as an actor, David Cronenberg, and that is one of them. That's terrible.
I like it.
Even by the high standards of the Friday the 13th franchise, that's not great. But 4 is good. Yes.
4 is great.
I will grant you that. 4 is a cracker.
If for no other reason than Crispin Glover's dancing.
You haven't asked me my favourite Friday the 13th.
I'm coming round to it. Becky is a stranger to these parts. I'm making her feel welcome by talking about horror films and gore and Crispin Glover and Corey Feldman and all the good stuff. Helen, what is your favourite Friday the 13th
movie? I would have to say the best of Friday the 13th.
Have you seen any?
I've seen the first one.
And you I'm stopping there.
I'm stopping. I have meant to go and do a deep dive, but I don't care very much. So, like, it's always been like, oh, one day I'll do a deep dive.
It's probably for the best, in fairness. But, you see, you've been denied the majesty of watching Jason Voorhees actually do his thing because, as we all know, the original Friday the 13th, unless you talk about the remake.
No, I've seen the remake as well. I've seen the more recent ones.
Your story's falling apart under question. So she's actually seen 2 Friday the 13th.
I have. Okay. And I think I've also seen Freddy versus Jason, if we're counting that.
Oh my God.
So. All right, she's digging herself into a hole with every passing sentence. As your lawyer, Helen.
I didn't know you were the biggest Friday the 13th fan.
I'm so big.
Helen has a Jason Voorhees tattoo. The hockey mask entirely on her face.
Which is
unusual. Jimbo, where do you stand on Jason Voorhees?
Very much in the same boat as Helen, floating on the waters of Camp Crystal Lake. I have seen the original Friday the 13th. I have seen its sequel, Saturday the 14th. And my favourite Friday the 13th is possibly Jason X, because, as you say, there's something deliciously camp and ridiculous about
but
Jason
it's shit.
In space. Oh, yeah, we're all shit, Chris. It's just degrees. And then Freddy versus Jason, because I like Freddy, and he's in that. And I don't care about Jason, but Freddy's in it. Therefore, it makes it great.
Jason.
Sorry.
He's misunderstood.
He's no Freddy.
You sound a lot like Pamela Voorhees right now.
Oh, Jason, he's very misunderstood. Oh, no, he's such a good boy. Yeah, thank you. Correct.
He's such a good boy. He's a very, very good boy. In fact, you could even say, for he's a jolly good fellow. No. For he's a jolly good fellow. For he's a jolly good fellow.
Which is the one in which someone's head gets exploded with a leather strap tightened against a tree?
Ooh. Oh, is that? Is that?
Is it two?
It's four. It's either between two.
I think it's two
and eight.
I don't know why. Thank you, Chris. I think it's two.
I should have that off the top of my head, and I do.
But
not.
That is one of those kills that is seared into my brain as being upsetting.
It's good.
Yeah.
Right. So, do you want a question?
Please.
Okay. We've After talked enough that, about please. Jason Voorhees. Let's talk now about romance, shall we? Because love is in the air.
Oh, no.
Do, 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 do. This comes from Ramus. Ramus on Blue Sky. Having just watched the seminal masterwork that is A Few from the Top, that's the Gwyneth Paltrow flight attendant rom-com, right. I believe, right? In which rom-coms have you found yourself rooting for the spurned lover? Because Ramus goes on to say, while I love Ruffalo, he offers Paltrow nothing other than a red jumper, whereas Rob Lowe's pilot is right there. So,
I mean, can you trust a pilot though? They're all sluts. Apologies to any pilots out there. No, it's a kind of a joke from
memo to self: never fly with Helen because she's going to be marked from now on.
Aren't they famous? But like, you know, isn't that the sort of cliche? I'm just saying.
Wow, you were really the hole digger this week, aren't you?
I really
you're properly getting yourself went way over your head.
Okay,
pilot is fabulous, and you know it.
Oh boy.
But we are a little bit slutty.
You are slutty,
though.
Yeah. You're very slutty, yeah. I think, okay, the obvious answer has got to be Sleepless in Seattle.
Oh, okay. Talk me through this.
And
I did not expect you to say this. I was
She's
just
not wrong.
Say,
so.
No,
She's
no,
not
no.
Wrong.
He is blameless. He is flawless. That is the whole point. He is a lovely man. It's Bill Pullman's character, whose name is.
Doesn't
Bill
he have an annoying laugh?
Pullman.
He hasn't. He goes.
No, I think his laugh is fine. He does snore or have some kind of weird sleep thing, I think. But like, he's a nice guy. He is solid. He is dependable, and not in a boring way. He is clearly smart and has, you know, a sense of humor, and he seems to really care about her, and he seems like a just great human being, and ultimately. He tells her to go because he realizes that, you know, she has to go. He's a great guy. So I don't want her to end up with him because the whole movie is about how she is destined, like mystically destined to end up with Tom Hanks. But he is flawless.
See, I haven't watched the film in a long, long time, and I thought that he was depicted as having flaws. It's more interesting, I think, in rom-coms and love triangles when all three points of the triangle have a point, and they're not, you know, because quite often the movie will then go out of its way to paint the guy or the girl that the hero doesn't end up with as an absolute fucking prick, a grade A bell end. But that doesn't do that. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Good, strong start. Powerful, confident. Becky is Friday the 13th does not count as.
Oh, I just want everybody to end up with Jason.
Oh no!
Oh, fucking hell!
All I can think of is literally the opposite answer to the question, which is when all of the guys that they're not meant to end up with are the worst people on the planet. And the one that really springs to mind for that is Glenn Gulia in Wedding Singer. Not only for the reason that her name would end up being Julia Gulia.
Great.
Which would be enough
its
own.
But that is not the answer to the question. So I don't know, like the obvious answer is my best friend's wedding, I guess. But I don't...
Oh, okay. Talk me through that.
It's the literal plot of the movie.
Is that Cameron Diaz is absolutely lovely. Now, here's the controversial opinion. She is the one who should get out of it because he is marrying her. She's like 20. She is dropping out of college to go traveling with him, a sports reporter. I mean, that is a bad decision,
it's a bad move.
Cameron.
It's a bad, bad life decision.
Yeah, you could
get
do better.
Out of there.
Yeah. Leave him to Julia Roberts. They deserve each other.
They deserve each other.
This is Dylan McDermott,
Thank
right?
You.
This is Dylan McDermott, sorry.
Yes.
No, it wasn't Dylan McDermott. Hi, everyone, it's Chris here. Just jumping in real quick to try and head you off at the pass because I know you were all shouting at your podcast device of choice. Dermot Mulroney, you were shouting Dermot Mulroney. He was the guy in my best friend's wedding and not Dylan McDermott. Listen, big mistake. We all take collective responsibility for it, but really, we all know it was James's fault. Anyway, back to the show.
I mean, okay. They have character names, but let's focus on the actors.
No, you don't need to know the character names. The character names are superfluous and unimportant. It's Bill Pullman facing off against Tom Hanks for Meg Ryan's hand in Sleepless in Seattle.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, ladies, would you choose Bill Pullman over Tom Hanks?
Oh, I mean,
how
look.
Dare you? Do you know what? I would go with Bill Pullman over Tom Hanks.
Because the way he leans?
Because Tom Hanks kind of reminds me of my dad, and that's inappropriate, and Bill Pullman is devilishly handsome.
I mean, Tom Hanks also reminds me of my dad, so that's probably right.
Yeah, I've met your dad.
If somebody was playing my dad in a movie, Tom Hanks would be top of the list.
Are you insane? Yeah.
No, I'm not
Are
kidding.
Have you lost your mind?
Oh my God.
Oh my God, twist.
This is wild. I've met your dad. He's a lovely, lovely guy, but he's...
No, I'm talking about like energy-wise. I'm not talking like looks particularly. But
I was thinking your dad is more like a kind of a James Rebhorn.
Oh, no.
than a Tom Hanks type. But you know, Helen's now frantic to Google. Yeah.
I'm like, she's trying to figure out if that's an insult or not.
It's not an insult. He's a fine character actor. Like James Cromwell. Your dad has strong James Cromwell energy.
James Rebhorn is too skinny and James Cromwell is too tall for my dad. So honestly,
but
he's
those
more
Tom
of a...
Hanks are far away. All right. Okay. So Becky has gone for that film you said.
My Best Friend's Wedding.
My Best Friend's Wedding. And James.
Having forgotten broadly what the question was, but just picking up the general gist from what you've been saying.
Love triangles where the person chose, the hero of the movie chose the wrong person in the end.
That's tricky. Do you know what? The thing that springs to mind immediately is probably Past Lives. Because I think she should have
left her husband.
I mean, look, I know it doesn't speak well of her character in that regard, but you can't argue with destiny. No, he is, like Thanos, inevitable.
But they'll get another chance in their next life.
Will
probably.
They, though?
Yes, apparently.
Maybe they're destined to fuck it up every time.
Oh. She has a lovely relationship with her husband.
I don't know. He was punching.
He seems nice, though.
Yeah.
Wow. You're a true monster.
This is really some dark stuff.
Sorry. Yeah.
I thought you would have gone for someone from Love Actually. You know, there's lots of love triangles in Love Actually.
There's a fair bit going on there, yes. But I think everyone makes a reasonably good decision, so...
You think?
Emma Thompson, maybe not.
So Win a Date with Tad Hamilton's a good contender, I think.
Okay.
Does anyone agree? I thought you would have said something like Pretty in Pink.
Oh, well, right? Pretty in Pink, arguably, like, I mean, there is the Ducky contingent, of course. She should have gone with John Cryer.
She should have gone with Ducky.
But also, maybe she shouldn't have gone with either of them.
That's also an option.
So I feel like...
Why do romantic comedies end that way with none of the above? The guys or the gals getting the guy or the gal or the gal and the guy.
Mostly my feelings about that are she should have gone with one of the dresses and not a third option with the dress.
I was just about to say this. Going back to our John Hughes ranking, where Helen and I went off on a 15-minute tangent about how terrible the dress she makes is.
So bad.
So Win a Date with Tad Hamilton is a 2004 film. I don't know if you guys have seen it. Have you seen it?
I saw it in 2004. So
directed by Robert Luketic, and it stars Kate Bosworth, Josh Duhamel, and Topher Grace. Kate Bosworth wins a competition to win a date with Tad Hamilton, who's a movie star played by Josh Duhamel. But in the end, she goes off with her ducky-like best friend, the guy who's always been there. She's always been standing in his doorway, or he's always been, someone's been standing in the other person's doorway, whatever happens. And she goes off with him. The problem with that is that he's a twat.
Is this Topher Grace?
This is Topher Grace. Grace, yeah. And he killed all his people in Predators.
He did.
And Josh Duhamel, Tad Hamilton.
Saved the world from Transformers.
Looks like Josh Duhamel. And the movie goes out of his way to paint him as a lovely guy. Charismatic, cool. It's like, what's not to like Kate Bosworth?
Well, maybe this is part of the romantic comedy trend to encourage women to settle for bad men. I saw this accusation even leveled at the Materialists last year. Slight spoiler for the Materialists. But that, you know, this is Poor Man Propaganda was one take on that movie. And I think there's something of that in Win a Date with Todd Hamilton as well.
A genuinely brilliant angle to take on that film. Poor Man Propaganda.
It is Poor Man Propaganda that...
She was spoiled for choice, to be fair.
I mean, look...
Pedro Pascal with his short legs...
his little stumpy legs. Yeah. In fairness, he had them. He did have them lengthened.
A lot of spoilers here.
They were on springy stilts, weren't they? Because he kept bouncing around in the background of scenes. Boing, boing.
Madame Webb was having a good dating day there, having to choose between
she would have
Cap
seen the future.
And Mr. Fantastic.
Madame Webb would have seen the future and figured out how that worked out.
Well, I mean, it's very mysterious, though. I don't think there was a right answer in that film, actually. I think it was kind of an interesting one. But I guess it comes down to the heart wants what it wants. Mm. But I do think Win a Date with Todd Hamilton is an interesting one because it is very much sort of, you won't be true to yourself if you don't, you know, stick with the guy back home.
That's Topher Grace propaganda is what that is.
That's kind of, but it is kind of that small town propaganda. I think it's the kind of thing that you get in quite a lot of, you know, the Hallmark-y Christmas movies and that kind of thing. Not just from Hallmark, but like there is a small C conservative attitude in a lot of those movies where you can't reach too far. Like where, you know, marriage is still sacrosanct in a lot of those movies. Like if you split up from your husband and there's a new lover on the horizon, chances are you're going to end up back with your husband. Like that's just the way it's going to go in those movies. And I feel like in a lot of those, oh, but your best friend is in love with you stories, you'll end up with the best friend, even though maybe you shouldn't. Mm. There was probably a reason you guys were friends in the first place, you know?
Yeah. Fair point. Thank you for the question, Ramis. That was a lovely, lovely question. And keep them peeled on social media platforms for more shout-outs for questions, folks. All right. Movie news time. Let's talk about the Super Bowl to an extent, I guess, because the Super Bowl was last Sunday night, of course, the Seattle Seahawks triumphant over the New England Patriots. Bad Bunny was the halftime show. Did anyone watch it?
It was very good. I don't care about the game.
No.
Helen didn't see the Bad Bunny thing because she was watching the Kid Rock concert on the other channel.
How dare you? I would have been like 1/14th of the audience, but I was absolutely not doing that.
So as well as all that, the on-pitch shenanigans, the halftime shenanigans, there were trailer shenanigans as always. There were a bunch of like Super Bowl spots for movies that are coming out in the summer. I don't think any of them really shed much more light on films like The Mandalorian and Grogu than we already had. But there was one that really did catch my eye. It is the trailer for the as yet officially untitled Cliff Booth movie with Brad Pitt, in which Brad Pitt returns to reprise his Oscar-winning role from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The screenplay, of course, has been written by Quentin Tarantino, but not directed by Quentin Tarantino. It is directed instead by David Fincher. Did anyone see this Super Bowl trailer?
It looks very cool.
It does look very cool. Also very dark. I couldn't make out a lot of what's going on, to be honest. But yeah, we got no sense of the plot or indeed the title.
Mm-mm.
And there were these really weird, I don't know if this was the squiggles that
scratchings.
Were all over it. Yeah, weird squiggles and scratchings, which we think may be to obscure cigarettes or things that maybe wouldn't be palatable for a Super Bowl audience. And they've just
swearing?
Swearing, yeah, because people's mouths are obscured at various points as well. Guns, things like that. But
it's quite a funny way of dealing with it if you've got to censor yourself for the big game spot.
Yes.
God, I hate that phrase. I'm excited about it. If you're not going to have QT direct your QT script, then get David Fincher. My God.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Let's talk about another trailer before we get into some more stuff. Trailer just dropped for Minions and Monsters, which is the third, I believe, standalone Minions film. It's coming out later on in the summer. And I think James will agree with me on this. It looks hilarious.
Do you know what? You laugh because there was a joke at the end, which was toilet-oriented, which I did not find amusing. But I have a soft spot for the Minions movies. I find them quite entertaining.
Really?
Yes.
Do you sense kindred spirits?
Perhaps, yes. I enjoy a Minion movie.
You are dressed in yellow and blue dungarees at the moment.
That's my look.
She's got one big eye in the centre
of my giant forehead.
I'd love to see you dressed as a Minion. Not for sex purposes, but
oh
just,
God.
You know. Yeah. I'd love to see it. Can okay. we make that happen?
We'll see what we can do.
Okay.
All we need is some yellow paint.
That's I mean, really just it. Add some dungarees, yeah.
Becky, you were very tickled by this trailer, in which the Minions are trying to make a movie, a monster movie, and they have to conjure up their own monster, and they conjure up a very pint-sized Cthulhu.
Tiny Cthulhu. I didn't know that this movie was a thing. I didn't know that the trailer was a thing until I arrived at the Empire offices and you were like, have you seen this? And then I looked it up.
You've really got your finger on the pulse of the horror movies coming out this year, haven't you?
And now I am not excited about any other movies at all. I just want to see this at the earliest possible opportunity.
We are in accord. All other movies have paled into insignificance.
I love a Minion anyway, and now they've sprinkled H.P. Lovecraft all over the top of it, and I'm like, yes,
and
yes,
classic
please.
Hollywood,
yeah,
because they're trying to make, you know, kind of classic era movies. I'm confused. I'm intrigued. I want to know more.
I'm so excited.
Genuinely, the Minions movies are kind of hilarious, and when they're stripped of the trappings of the Despicable Me franchise, where there has to be a lesson and they have to learn shit, these are like almost Gremlins movies in a way. They're very, very anarchic, and they're gag machines.
Well, the rise of Gru had a bit of both. I thought that kind of got the alchemy right between them. Some of the Despicable Me sequels have been a bit whatever, but yeah, they are
funny.
The first one.
See, I think people, when the first Minions movie came on, it's like they're good as, well, Minions, you know, as sidekicks, comic relief, but do they work as the protagonists of the film? And surprisingly, King Bob, they really do.
The answer is yes.
But ultimately, I've got to the point now with these films where I find Gru quite aggravating and all the kind of humanoid characters. Indeed. Whereas actually, the Minions for me are the reason to turn up. Like, they're the main event. Mm. I'm all in.
You and every 5-year-old in the world.
Exactly.
Yes. It will make $25 billion. You heard it here
Hello.
First.
Nah.
Who did the fart noise? Becky! Fantastic. Well done.
You're so welcome.
Oh, we found our level. all right. That's exciting. Minions and Monsters. Very, very exciting. Also exciting is the news that Jerry Butler has made a new movie. I love the title. It's called Empire City.
Oh.
So.
Finally. They've made a movie about you guys.
They've made a movie with the word empire in the title. They've never done that before. And this is about terrorists who take over, apparently, the Empire State Building. And he is a former Navy SEAL turned firefighter who teams up with his cop wife, who I believe is played by Hayley Atwell, to right the wrongs and show the terrorists the exit door.
Amazing.
Who, who's the main guy who plays?
Jerry Butler.
Jerry Butler.
Oh my God. Jerry Butler.
Wait for it. What's his character's first name, Chris?
Well, Helen, his character's name in this is Rhett. That is right. Rhett Butler.
Wow.
It's finally happened. It has finally happened. I don't need to see any more. In fact, I would prefer not to. And I've already given this 5 stars. 5 stars then for Empire City. There was some other exciting news in the week. Huge news that Tom Hanks is making Greyhound 2. You may ask yourself, what the fuck was Greyhound 1?
Greyhounds.
Greyhound. Tom Hanks walked into Apple, wrote Greyhound on a blackboard.
Dollar sign in it, yeah. it's a battleship film, isn't it, Greyhound?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not the game. It's not another battleship movie.
You have sunk my battleship.
Yeah, no, we're not doing that again.
E-12.
Look, if Alexander Skarsgård couldn't make that happen, who else could?
Was he in that film?
Yeah, briefly. He got killed near the start. Anyway, spoilers for Battleship, I guess.
No one's going to watch Battleship.
That's fair.
Isn't Rihanna in that?
Yes.
Yes, she is. She's like a midshipman type.
And Tim Riggins.
Tim Riggins, Taylor Kitsch, of course. Yeah, yeah. And the problem with it wasn't Kitsch enough.
It wasn't.
It was just shit.
It hit a berg, an iceberg, or a Peterberg.
Do you know that... did you know that 70% of Peter Berg's body is always beneath the surface?
Of the earth,
Helen. The Peter Berg we see is only 30% of Peter Berg. There's more beneath.
How does
more beneath?
How does that work? I'm so confused. That's just physiology. I mean, it just doesn't make much sense. Can he go?
You've broken Helen. You've broken Helen. You see what you've done? You've actually broken Helen. Who knew of all the years we've done this podcast, it would be that joke, that particular terrible joke that would be Helen's end. Look, she's gone to pieces. Look at her.
I don't know why.
She can't even speak. The iceberg Peter Berg joke was the winner. Please note the date and time, Becky.
I had no idea. I would have deployed it years ago. Unbelievable. Anyway.
It doesn't make any sense.
How would he get into cars? How would he walk into buildings?
Can he walk upstairs? No.
Part of him.
I've seen it happen.
Well, it's there you true. Go. I have too.
Yeah.
I was on set of that oil rig movie. He was upstairs.
Yeah. He took down the Titanic. Anyway. Peter Berg, dead end. Just Peter Berg, just clawing at ships. Anyway, Greyhound 2, that's very exciting. Very exciting news. Tom Hanks and Stephen Graham, who were apparently both in the first film, are going to return in this one. So that's good news. It's shooting right now. It's going to be on Apple.
Nice.
And as many people will see it on Apple as saw the first movie. So
can't wait.
Can't wait. Happy news. For those 12 people. A film that loads of people are going to go see, guaranteed, is the next Mummy movie.
Yes.
And we know when they're going to see it now, don't we?
When are you going to see it, Jimbo?
They're going to see it in 2028 on May the 19th.
Right, so we have to stay alive.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Everybody just calm down.
Everybody just chill, okay? We need this. We really, really need this. We need Rick and Evelyn back. Exploring tombs and, you know, getting into trouble with mummies.
Yeah.
Who are Rick and Evelyn?
Rick and Evelyn are the characters played by Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz in the original movie.
Rachel Weisz.
Yes. Who are delightful and wonderful, and they are one of my favorite all-time screen couples, actually.
Do you stan them?
I do stan them very much, to the point where when they tried to recast her, I was having none of it.
Ooh, that's a bad love triangle. She should have ended up with Imhotep.
Yeah. But like Maria Bello, great actress, but no, it was all wrong. Why are you bringing the minions back? Oh my God, what if they opened a tomb? What if they opened a tomb and photoreal minions came out?
I mean, that would be glorious.
In the Mummy 4.
See, now we've broken Becky. Look what's happened. This podcast is carnage.
Anyway.
Oh, dear. Yes.
Good stuff.
Anyway, Radio Silence are making it. It's going to be great.
That's exciting. No, Mummy movie's happening again. We're all excited about that, aren't we, folks? Yes.
We are. Yay. I mean, we are.
Okay, just don't come at me with your mummy skepticism. I have no time for it. It is a good movie.
Jimbo,
I love it.
Do you have mummy skepticism?
Yes, I prefer daddy's, as in daddy's home.
Sure.
Daddy sauce.
Are you sure about this?
I think you may have backed yourself into a corner.
I was really hoping you wouldn't interrogate that.
So, rather than a new mummy movie coming out in May 2028, you would rather have Daddy's Home 3.
Yes. Reuniting Mel Gibson and whoever else is in it.
Oh, but you don't really care. As long as it's Mel Gibson's in it, you're happy as
Absolutely.
Larry.
Yeah. Oh, okay. God. This has gone horribly wrong.
I mean, well, if I had said, I don't want the mummy, I want a daddy, like that would be something, but you're just, you know, you're just on the hiding to nothing.
Helen, you have transferred your whole digger crown to James. Very nicely done.
I guess that's appropriate for archaeology.
You call it archaeology. So, Mike Flanagan, this is a big shock, is about to direct a Stephen King adaptation.
No. Surely not. Next, you'll tell us he's doing Poe or something. This doesn't make any sense.
Poe. He is going to direct. Can you guess what it is? Do you know what it is?
I know what it is.
Oh, I have no idea.
Jim, guess. Three guesses.
Oh, okay.
I'll narrow it down for you.
Okay.
It's been adapted before.
The Tommyknockers.
Incorrect.
Okay. Is it Needful Things?
Also incorrect.
I wish.
That'd be cool, actually.
Has it been adapted previously as a film?
Yes.
Oh.
And a pretty good one.
Oh.
Really good one.
Oh. It's not going to be The Shining.
Correct.
Thank you. Is it Misery?
No.
I'm out of guesses.
But your first three letters were right.
Mm. Oh. I don't think that helps me.
Really?
Yeah.
The first three letters of Misery are the same three letters as the main word of this movie?
This. There's only one other letter?
I can't, The Mist!
Yeah!
The Mist! The Mist! Oh, that is a good adaptation. Do you think this will have a happy ending? Do you think about a happy ending? I can barely even... Do you know what? I'm so fucking traumatised by the ending of The Mist that Frank Darabont did that I can't even say it out loud without stuttering.
You've forgotten that happiness exists.
Genuinely, and I've said this before... I've never felt more bleak coming out of a film than I did coming out of that. You just wander around like in a funk. Mm-hmm. Just it's so dark.
And have you seen Daddy's Home Too? I
mean, literally the same ending.
I wish.
But, yeah. But I'd be fascinated to know what he'll do with the ending of this, because I feel like at this point, if you don't have a really bleak ending, it's going to feel like a cop-out.
It's not going to feel like a cop-out.
It is.
The original novella does not have a bleak ending.
It
literally ends on the word hope. I mean, it's a dark ending, and that they're probably still all going to die, but there is a note of hope in the future for the survivors.
Like Rogue One?
The Mist. Yes. Yes, James. Exactly like
not
Rogue One.
Very like Rogue One.
Well, it ends on the same word.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, that's true.
Yeah, so does Shawshank Redemption.
Mm.
Okay.
All right.
Are you surprised that he's remaking The Mist? Because A, The Mist wasn't that long ago, and B, it is widely considered to be one of the better King adaptations by Frank Darabont.
I am surprised. He's become so synonymous with King adaptations, but even before that comes along, he's like going in a completely different direction doing the new Exorcist movie.
Yeah.
And you sort of think, I don't know, if you were going to do any of the... King stories. Mm. Even after he's doing the Carrie show, I don't think The Mist would be the one that would be top of my list. I would have gone like Needful Things or Thinner, you know.
Ooh, yeah,
one of the ones that like...
That was not a good adaptation.
Exactly. No. Hasn't already been well done. Frank Darabont behind it, you know?
It does seem like this has already been covered.
Yeah.
But did you watch the Mist TV show at all?
I did not.
I watched all of that. It got cancelled, so it didn't get a proper ending. But it wasn't very good, but it was strong.
What did it do?
Watchable. It was mainly them going from house to house, dodging the mist. But it was right.
I didn't see it. But this is interesting. Flanagan's talked openly about wanting to make The Dark Tower, which is, of course, mm-hmm. King's magnum opus and would be huge and epic and would require many, many films and probably TV shows as well to do it right, which they, of course... did not do catastrophically when they made it for the big screen a few years ago with...
It's not a film, that is a show.
But I think that's also why he has not made that.
It feels like this is something that Apple should be all over, because The Dark Tower will require so much money and a significant commitment of seasons. I feel like Apple are the only people who are likely to take that on.
Mm, that's true.
He is trying to make films. So we shall see what happens with that. But we'll keep an eye on it. He's making the new Exorcist first, so he won't get around to this for at least a couple of years.
Isn't he also on Clayface as well?
No, he wrote Clayface.
He wrote it, okay.
Yeah, so. James Watkins is directing
that.
But there you go. That is very, very exciting indeed. Very, very sad note now to end the movie news section, because we lost this week, we lost James Van Der Beek. Dawson himself from Dawson's Creek. I think this is a very dictionary definition of gone too soon.
Mm-hmm.
From cancer at the age of just 48.
Mm.
Jesus. And Bud Cort, star of the classic movie Harold and Maude, who was 77.
Yeah.
Very sad.
Very sad.
A massive cult figure and a massive figure in 70s cinema, Bud Cort, of course, just because he was in things like Harold Maude and MASH and Brewster McCloud and, you know, all of those, and then kind of had a second career, I guess, as a star of, I don't know, transgressive films, I guess, you know, things like But I'm a Cheerleader, even a supporting role as Romero in Coyote Ugly. I think for an entire generation of millennials, I think that... The loss of James Van Der Beek is deeply felt this week.
Yeah.
Mm.
But like 48, no age.
Oh my God, it's nothing, is it? And he leaves behind such a legacy, not only in terms of like his acting career, because obviously Dawson is his big, big role, but he was in things like Varsity Blues and the... in Apartment 23 playing himself, which was a hilarious turn.
Good in
I
that.
Loved
yes.
it.
Rules
he was
of attraction.
So good. Mm. Yeah, of course. But he just seems like he was such a beautiful soul, the way that he seemed to kind of handle his cancer diagnosis and the kind of fight against it alongside his family. He's got like 6 kids, just tragedy all round.
Yeah, it's awful. Absolutely awful. James van der Beek and Bud Cort, who passed away this week. Let's finish off the news section now by talking about the new issue of Empire, but not at length as we used to do, because we obviously have a dedicated show that does that. It is called The Shameless Plug, of course, but what will it be shamelessly plugging? Helen.
Hey.
Tell us.
Well, this is the Masters of the Universe issue, which is the film on the cover, and Dan Jolin has the whole story about that and spoken to all the people involved to find out about their, you know, bodybuilding routines, I guess. I actually haven't read that feature yet, but it looks really good. well done, me. We've got Ready or Not 2, Here I Come, yes. which is very exciting.
Still we should have, lose the two. They should lose
agree.
The two.
I agree with you.
You
what
don't shout
I
out
do?
When you're doing hide and seek. You don't shout, Ready or Not 2, Here I Come. Look, you just shout out, Ready or Not.
Why are you
silly.
Telling me? Anyway, we also have a look at the incredible medical drama, The Pit, which is off the frickin' charts. Great. We have The Magic Faraway Tree, which Alex is extremely excited about. James McAvoy is talking about his directorial debut, California Schemin'. And we have the story of the most depressing film ever made that isn't called The Mist, Threads.
Oh, yeah.
A film that Sam Toy put on for us, Chris and James, once on a Saturday night. He invited us over to his house.
Beautiful.
And put on Threads for us to watch. And we had to watch an hour of comedy and eat an entire chocolate pavlova in order to rebalance ourselves afterwards.
Good
God.
It was an ordeal.
Sam,
but it's an incredible film.
What the fuck? What the fuck, Sam?
Still love you, though.
Yeah, absolutely. It was Bill Bailey, wasn't it? We watched
Bill Bailey. It was Bill Bailey.
Yeah, it seared into my brain that.
What a night.
Yeah. Is Threads more depressing than The Mist?
I honestly think it's up there. It's really up there.
Well, The Mist is mainly depressing at the very end.
Exactly.
It's not depressing throughout.
Exactly. Whereas Threads is just like one battle after another, if you will.
Because it's set in Sheffield.
Because it's set in Sheffield when a nuclear war happens and basically wipes out civilization, and then they're still in Sheffield and they have to try and, you know, survive or whatever in the aftermath. It's horrible.
I don't believe The Mist has a character in the credits.
Woman urinating on herself.
Urinates on herself. Yeah. Oh dear.
It could do. And in fact, if you're making a movie and you don't have a character called Woman Urinating on Herself, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
Is The Mist more or less depressing than Win a Date with Todd Hamilton?
It's more depressing than Win a Date with Todd Hamilton. Right. Even though I know you think she picked the wrong guy, it's still more depressing.
All I'm saying. What else is in the magazine? Rennie Harlan. I spoke to Rennie Harlan for Big Old Feature, trawling through his career, directing spectacular set pieces. And there are other amazing things in the magazine as well. I don't have a copy to hand right now. You're just going to have to take my word for it. But that is available right now in all good, evil, and virtual newsagents. Rush out immediately and buy it, consume it, and then prepare yourself. Live a monastic life for the next 2 weeks whilst waiting for the episode of The Shameless Plug to drop, in which I discuss the issue in depth with Nick Desemlian, the editor of Empire. That is what you must do. So there you go. That is your job. Right. Shall we have a guest?
Let's.
Emerald Fennell, who, of course, was the director of Promising Young Woman and then Saltburn. And now she's back with Wuthering Heights, or open quote marks, Wuthering Heights, close quote marks, as it is presented on the poster. And that might indicate that this is not a hugely faithful adaptation of the classic novel by Emily Bronte.
Well done, Chris. That English degree really paying off.
I had a 33% chance.
Crushed it.
it was either her or Charlotte Bronte.
Hey, or come on, bring it home, Chris.
Come
bring
on, you've got it.
Jeremy Bronte and Bronte. Come on, they're in and around the Banbridge. Banbridge, my hometown, is Bronte
it's
country.
Bronte country, according to the tourist board.
Were they
can't
ever
move
there
for Brontes?
Yeah, can't,
lousy with them.
You can't throw a stone in Banbridge without hitting a Bronte. That's the truth. Were they ever in Banbridge? It's hard to tell, but we claimed them anyway, so that's good. Anyway, Emily Bronte wrote Wuthering Heights,
correct.
Which is about Kate Bush running up that hill. And now she's made this, Emerald Fennell's made this new version starring Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi. And it's all rather steamy and there's lots of rumpy pumpy, isn't there, Hell's Bells?
There is some rumpy bumpy, yes, yeah. Correct. Yes. And I spoke to Emerald Fennell all about it and asked her a little bit about, you know, her choices in making this film.
All right. This is what we're about to hear. I'm excited. I'm excited to listen to this and learn more.
And she was wearing a very cool sort of heavy metal inspired t-shirt that says the Bronte sisters in like sort of like Megadeth font.
Ooh,
pretty cool.
That all does right. sound pretty cool.
We'll be back in a second for more explosive revelations from that interview. Here is Emerald Fennell talking to Hell's Bells. Enjoy.
This is a passion project for you and has been since you were a teenager, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I first read the book when I was 14 and it just completely obliterated me, you know? It has the most upending effect on you. And after Saltburn, I knew that the thing I wanted to make afterwards would be emotionally connective and physically connective. I like movies that make you feel, and it's why I love the cinema in particular. I like people going to experience movies together and feel things together. And so whenever I was thinking of that kind of visceral experience, I just kept going back to the thing that made me feel that way, and that was Wuthering Heights.
Mm. So tell me about the process of adapting it, because obviously you've lost the entire sort of second generation that the book has and kind of focused in a little bit more on Cathy and Heathcliff. But, you know, what were you looking for? Did you go back and sort of, you know, go line by line, or was it very much like starting from that feeling and that overarching takeaway?
Well, the first thing I did was wrote down everything. I've read Wuthering Heights, you know, since I first read it. I'd read it many, many times, but I probably hadn't reread it in a couple of years. And so the first thing I did was write down everything I remembered.
Right.
Whether it was lines of dialogue or whether it was, you know, just feelings or scenes, anything like that. And then when I reread the book, I was able to kind of work out what was there and what was wish fulfillment or what was a kind of complete misremember, you know. And so part of it was kind of trying to approximate the feeling that the book had given me as much as the book itself. Because I think, you know, the reason that, of course, we've done away with the second generation and with Lockwood as well, the kind of the first sort of narrator, the first framing narrator, is you only have 2 hours. You've got approximately 2 hours and to turn something as like gargantuan as Wuthering Heights into that, you have to consolidate characters, you have to make decisions, you have to choose the particular thread. And this book is massive and it's deeply personal to everyone who reads it. And it has so many stories within stories. It has so many different ways of telling it. And I knew that I couldn't encompass all that it is in one thing. But what I could do was sort of, you know, I could show what it meant to an extremely sort of emo 14-year-old girl, you know? That's what I can do. And that's why it's in inverted commas. You know, I can't possibly say that you can't make an adaptation, actually. You can only make a response. That's why Kate Bush's song is such a great adaptation, you know? And it's why like Balthus's illustrations are so good. It's actually, you can only really do your own thing on it, I think.
Do your own thing on it, yeah. Let the record show, just for listeners, that you are wearing all black at the moment. So you're, you know, you're carrying the emo torch.
And can I just do a shout out to the Literary Emporium, who is a young woman who makes these unbelievably cool, like band, like thrash metal Bronte Sisters band t-shirts. And it is my favorite thing in the world.
It's an excellent t-shirt, and I will be looking it up as soon as we finish. So thank you. But yeah, so tell me then about casting. Now, obviously, you've worked with both of these people before, albeit mostly Margot as a producer rather than as your star. But casting Jacob based on the book cover resemblance, I thought was fascinating. So first of all, people are going to want to look up this edition. Do you remember anything about which edition of Wuthering Heights this was?
I've been trying to find it because I thought it was at my parents' house in my old bedroom. And then I couldn't find it. I'll be able to kind of do an internet trawl. But what it was is it was a sort of, you know, slightly, I would say, misguided in the sense that it was sort of like a romantic bodice ripper. It was sort of windy and she was wet, you know, she was sort of very busty running across the moors and he's like holding on to her and he has his hair in the wind and his sideburns and you know, it was just when Jacob was in Saltburn, obviously the 2005 sideburns were all the rage. And he came out and it was just like, and that there was that feeling of like, oh my God, that was my first sort of romantic awakening was sort of Heathcliff. And of course, because I was 14, that's kind of also... That the sort of, I suppose, the cover had sort of made itself
imparted almost
the book. And in the same way that like the song has, and then the other movies have, that's another thing that I think is really important for me when I make films is I can't ever forget the like relationship that things and people have to an audience. Or like, you know, like none of us are going to things without a prior, our own complicated inner prior relationships, you know, so every time you're sort of looking at casting or music or whatever, it's sort of always about sort of trying to like trigger those feelings that people give you. And I think that, you know, Jacob just had that sort of, it's that Byron-esque, it's the Byron-esque anti-hero look, isn't it? But I think Lord Byron basically based on himself and his own face. But you know, I just, for me, it's always about like an emotional connection and what people make me feel. And so it's the same with Margot. You know, Kathy in the book is 18. And as people have, you know, been sort of quick to say, she's sort of not blonde. But the thing is about Margot is what I wanted to do was Kathy's a star. She's a star. That's what she is. She is Elizabeth Taylor. That's who I was thinking of for this movie. I was thinking Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. Like, who are those unbelievably huge, like megawatt charisma machines? And that's because that's what Kathy is. Mm-hmm. She's a star with no one to look at her. And when nobody looks at her, she loses her mind. And so the thing about Margot is she brings all that with her. Not only is she unbelievably gifted as an actress, and she really is, she's exquisite, but she also has that aura as well, and people who come to see this movie have a, you know, they know who she is. It's sort of mad to not, it's mad to try and discount that. And so it's always about saying like, what if it was, you know, a Margot Robbie, although of course Margot is the nicest person in the world, but you know, in the middle of nowhere, that then gives you the kind of information you need before even kind of she opens her mouth in a funny way. So it's always that stuff. And for the rest of the cast, you know, it's just people I'm obsessed with, essentially.
Fair enough, really, yeah. So was it always those two? Like it just came together pretty quickly in that case?
The thing is, it is these sort of, it's like, but it's also like passing feelings too, because... Mm-hmm. When I was making Saltburn, I only ever do one thing at a time. So I'm not working on multiple projects, but what I do have are like imaginary worlds that I live in and I live in for years. And Wuthering Heights has been one of those now for, you know, whatever, 25 years. And so it's always kind of a nebulous thought. You know, when I saw Jacob, I was like, it's a kind of, it's an, oh, that's interesting. Why are those sideburns, which at the time on like boys at the time when I was young, I was like, ew, why is it this man now that I'm having that feeling? And I was like, oh, it's that, it's my sort of 14-year-old girl self. And so that's kind of what happens. But really, then I just write the script. Everything is a very specific stage for me.
Mm.
So I was living in the world, and then I write the script, and then I don't think about casting. And then the moment that it's finished, and I look at it, and I look at the kind of way that I want to make it, and who I feel would be right, then that's the kind of moment. But with Margot, I never asked her, because I sent it to her as a producer purely because we've worked together three times, and I didn't want to put her on the spot.
Yeah.
You know, because of who she is, I didn't want to ask her to be in my film and for her to feel kind of obliged.
Right.
And so luckily she volunteered, and that made it much easier.
I think she says the same actually about that. Talk to me about your costumes and your production design, because they are wild. There is so much color here. There is so much texture. There is, you know, broken glass and flesh walls and all sorts of craziness. How did that come together? Was that a gradual process, or did it just get wilder and wilder and wilder as you went?
No, it's all very considered and very kind of a lot of sort of detailed conversations when it comes to things like that. I mean, the thing for me, firstly, is that, you know, Emily Bronte was a visionary genius. And the thing about visionary geniuses is that they are connected in a way that other people aren't. And there are very, very few of them.
Mm.
And they transcend time and space. And that sounds extremely wanky, but I don't know how else to describe it, because I don't know how else you could be William Shakespeare or Emily Bronte and be able to have such an immediate, profound effect on people so many hundreds of years later.
Yeah.
Because there are novels that you enjoy, there are plays that you enjoy, and there are ones that tell you about what it is to be a person.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to Emily Bronte and it comes to adapting her work, she was a poet in many ways more than she was a novelist. And she was out of her time. And so she lived in an imaginary world. She and her sisters and her brother lived in an imaginary world, to the extent that when she went briefly to teach at a girls' school nearby, she was so distressed because she didn't have time to live in her imaginary world that her father brought her home, because she really thought she would die.
Mm.
And so we're thinking about, for me, it didn't feel kind of right to make something that was just reflective, just an approximation of the time in which she was living, or the time in which the book is set, which is, you know, 50 years before, because it's not that.
Mm.
It's not actually that. It sort of didn't feel right. So what I had to do instead was say, like, if the root of the Gothic is emotional, purely emotional, what does the emotional landscape look like here? And it's not just the emotional landscape of Yorkshire, but it's the emotional landscape of Wuthering Heights, the place, and Thrushcross Grange, the place.
Yeah.
But the thing that I always held was the kind of the center of this to me, is the center of this story is nature, and one's true deep nature, and what happens when you don't let that nature kind of be. And so at Wuthering Heights, the place, me and Susie had a lot of conversations and worked with so many different people, from, you know, special effects to create the rain and the mist, and then the kind of animal handlers. So we had real horses, and then, you know, Nicola Turner, the incredible sculptor, to create a place that felt like nature was always interrupting it. So, you know, it was in script that the rocks that surround it are kind of coming into the house, and then as time passes, the house is kind of being pulled apart by these sort of tumorous growths that Nicola made for us out of horsehair, you know. And then you go to Thrushcross and it's the opposite. It's nature contained. It's taxidermy. It's Kathy's skin made into sort of beautiful silk panels. It's hands, it's sort of disembodied hands holding kind of beautiful natural artifacts. You know, it's a place that has taken great pains to make nature palatable. And so, you know, whether it's the corsets, whether it's, you know, even props like the bridle or the dog collar, everything in this film is about constraining nature and what a damaging effect that has on us all. And so those are the kind of conversations we always have. They're emotional, I think, and they're expressive. And that's why it's such a joy.
What kind of, you know, were you watching things, you know, while you were like in pre-production and putting it all together? Were you sort of just looking for kind of colors and tones and ideas?
I think not really. It's more like everything. And I think it goes back to Wuthering Heights is we all have a kind of taste. We all have a sort of a thing that gets us going. And, you know, so for this film, of course, we were looking at the old kind of Hollywood, the old studio soundstage melodramas and what they made us all feel, that kind of like vast emotion. So it was like obviously looking at Gone with the Wind, and we make reference to that. But then also looking again at like Burton Taylor, looking at Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, looking at The Night Porter, and Dirk Bogarde and Charlotte Rampling, one of the most troubling films of all time, but also kind of, you know, very much it's in a kind of shares a world, dark world with you know, Kathy and Heathcliff. You know, always Powell and Pressburger, always Derek Jarman, always Peter Greenaway.
Yeah.
Always. And then for pleasure, you know, it will always be, I mean, you know, sort of boring but important, kind of Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg and Alfred Hitchcock. I like to make movies for an audience.
Yeah.
It means a lot to me that they're engaged in it. Like, that's what I want to do. I'm not trying to make something, even though I think my films, I hope, are very, very personal, maybe to a sort of degree that is sort of slightly exposing sometimes.
Yeah.
I want to make things for people in a room. And so I always look to them. And then, like, obviously, Sofia Coppola is, you know, watching her work and what she's done for so many of us to make us know that you can make stories about women for women, and they can be vast and beautiful and troubling. You know, she's just a forever kind of hero of mine. But, you know, then I'm looking at like Julia Davis too,
mm-hmm.
and those kinds of people, you know, transgressive women across the board.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
All right, that was Emerald Fennell talking about Wuthering Heights. It's now time to delve deep into the movies that are out this week in the multiplexes and indeed on your silverplexes. Let's talk about Wuthering Heights to begin with. Let's rank the Bronte sisters. Helen, Emily, Charlotte, Anne, or would you go Anne, Emily, Charlotte?
I'll be honest, I haven't read The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, so I know.
You?
It's real long, but...
James, we found the book that Helen hasn't read.
Surely not.
Yeah. And it is The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte. Why didn't you read it?
It's real long.
You've
and I don't love the Brontes
books.
To begin with, so...
You don't love the Brontes to begin
with? I'm more of an Austen girl.
Snapshack marry the Bronte sisters.
Well, I mean, that's like, it would be, it's obviously, I've obviously snubbed Anne.
Yeah.
You'd shag Emily because she's clearly unstable and you'd marry Charlotte.
Correct.
Like, why are we not killing any of them? It's because they're already dead.
Yeah.
Snub.
Is that the genteel version?
That is what I used to do at school, and I don't like any other version. I will not have them.
Well, you don't like fuck, marry, kill?
No, snub, shag, marry.
Very chaste, isn't it?
It's not that chaste. There's a lot of shagging going on.
Still shagging.
Well, that's true. That's true. And there's a lot of shagging going on in Wuthering Heights as well, isn't there? Becky, talk us through this movie. Tell the good folks what they can expect.
There is some shagging in this movie.
I was led to believe it was wall-to-wall romping.
Right.
That
I
is
bought
incorrect.
10 tickets
that
for
is,
the weekend.
That is not
I'll get a refund.
Correct. It's very long, and I would say that the shagging... The film is very long, and I would say that the shagging takes up a relatively brief percentage of that quite hefty runtime. When the sex is on screen, it's pretty good sex. I liked the bit with the bridal, and there's about a 10-minute montage section between Heathcliff and Kathy, where they are shagging in various different places all over the moors. Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Yeah, this is doing the job." Mm.
This is horrific. I need you to give me a time code so I can skip this bit when I go to see it.
Of course, because you're a very chaste man.
Chased into the screening, chased out the screening.
He only plays marry, marry, marry. That's what Chris is interested in.
Anyway, tell folks who don't know what Rotherham Heights is, and that may or may not include myself, what this is, and who are Heathcliff and Kathy?
Who are they?
What's going on?
On a kind of windy moor. This is very gothic. It's very windswept.
This is near Sheffield, right?
Yes.
Post-threads.
Yes. It's a good question.
Yeah, it's actually set in the nuclear winter just after Threads.
This might explain why the moors are so windswept, right? It's in nuclear winter.
A young girl is being brought up by her father, who is a drunken gambling lout played by Martin Clunes, and her companion Nellie, who's another lady, but not as much of a lady as Kathy is. And then one day, Dad brings home a young boy.
Oh.
He's been out drinking again, and he defends this young lad, and he brings him home to be Kathy's pet, essentially. She teaches him how to read. She's a bit mean to him for a little while. This is Heathcliff.
Mm. And is he played by Jacob Lordy at this point, or is he not yet?
Not.
Owen Cooper at this point.
Oh, from adolescence.
Yes. And Charlotte Mellington is the young Kathy, and she's great.
Right.
And I think all three of the kids are really good. Who plays young Nelly, please?
Young Nelly is Vi Nguyen.
Vi Nguyen.
And Hong Chow is obviously the grown-up Nelly.
Amazing. So
really good cast.
They grew up then to be Jacob Elordi and Margot Robbie.
Correct.
And there's lots of sexual tension.
There is. And at that point, she's like, well, I can't marry him because he is poor. Ew.
Is this poor man propaganda again?
Gross. No, not really.
No, very much not. Because first of all, he goes off and gets rich when she spurns him. And second of all, he's a terrible person. Mm. Now, to be fair, she is also a terrible person.
All right.
Spoiled brat, very entitled. A new neighbour moves in next door, Mr. Linton.
Played by Shahzad Latif.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
With and his ward, who's played by Alison Oliver.
Yes. And is it his ward or is his sister?
In the book, it's his sister. Now it's a ward.
Okay.
Oh, we'll get to this in a second about the deviations from the sacred text.
Deviation is the word for this movie.
Okay.
Kathy, even though she is madly, lustfully in love with Heathcliff, he is not the right match for me. And she accepts Mr. Linton, the rich man down the road, his proposal. And then she immediately thinks, no, I've made a horrible mistake. But it's too late. Heathcliff has already left. And so she enters into this very unhappy marriage with the nice man down the road. But she's very unhappy because she wants wild Heathcliff. And then Heathcliff comes back and he's rich and he's got a tan and he's shaved off his beard.
And
he's
got, like,
he's got a
shit.
Slutty little earring.
Yeah.
Slutty.
It's very slutty. Yeah.
And then,
they decide
they need a 10-minute montage of lots of shagging all over the moors, and then it all ends very tragically.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And my understanding is that the book by Emily or Charlotte or Anne Bronte was because it was of its time.
Yeah.
So you couldn't use words like engorged.
Or tumescent
or liquescent. You couldn't use words like that. So it was quite, you know.
Finger bang.
Becky Dark. Unbelievable.
Oh, God.
This is a proper podcast for proper people.
Is it not?
Then why did you invite me?
Yeah, Yeah, Emily Bronte wasn't much given to using the term finger banging when describing Heathcliff and Kathy.
More's the pity.
More's the pity, very good. Right. And am I right in thinking that Emerald Fennell has taken some liberties then?
Yeah, but I kind of feel like that's the liberty that, you know, previous adaptations have also taken with this text, because, you know, there is a sexual undercurrent to their relationship. That's kind of baked in. And I understand leaning into that a bit. It's a choice, but it's a choice that I understand. There are so many other choices in this film that I do not. Mm-mm. And look, Emerald talked about this a lot in the interview, and I get that this is what she's going for. She's going for this emotional interpretation of how she felt as a 14-year-old reading the novel for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what she's got. I think the quotation marks are earned, though.
Yes. Mm.
And I think, you know, equally in the other direction, I think the skepticism and in some cases outright hostility of fans of the book has also been earned.
Agreed.
It has. It's been quite divisive, this one. Performance is good?
Yeah, I didn't have any issue really with the performances. I mean, I think the casting we can quibble with, but the actual work that these actors did, I think, is very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I think on the whole, they are very good, actually. I think Jacob Elordi again puts in a really brilliant performance. I'm continuously impressed by him.
Yeah.
He's much more than just a pretty face. And he's got that real kind of looming presence.
By necessity, he kind of bends over her at all times when they're to talk to her. And so it is almost like one of those illustrations of, you know, when like Dracula's leaning over the top of someone, and it's almost... Leaning.
Dracula loved to lean.
Yeah.
Bill Pullman would have been a great Dracula.
And, you know, there are quite valid questions about the casting of Jacob Elordi, but I think his performance is very good.
Yeah.
I think everybody else is pretty good, including the kids, actually, which I think is important because that's your entry into these characters. I would say that Margot Robbie is spectacularly miscast. And the character of Kathy from the book is meant to be this kind of dark-haired, wild teenager. And you just don't get that with Margot Robbie. Not because she can't play that, but that's just not
who she is.
And actually, as the film goes on and Kathy does become a little more adult and a little more kind of damaged, really, I think that Margot Robbie does a better job. But at that beginning, when you first sort of meet her as a young woman, I was really struggling to kind of set aside my disbelief.
They're both weird choices, I think, for those roles. But I do think she's very good in portraying that kind of someone who cannot help but lash out at everyone around her. I thought she was really good in those moments in particular. But yeah, it's a weird cast for a film. But they do good work. I think Martin Clunes is actually fantastic.
He's so good.
Of course he is.
So
he's Doc Martin, for God's sake.
I know, I shouldn't have
been
surprised.
A dependable pair of hands. But listen, we got to wrap this one short. It sounds very, very interesting indeed. This has been, as I said, a very divisive movie. Critics, it seems, are giving us either 5 stars or 1 star. There is no in between. So naturally, we've given it 3. 3 stars then for Wuthering Heights. Next up, Jimbo.
Yes.
Give us the Crime 101, please.
The 101 on Crime 101. This is Bart Layton's new film, and it is a 90s throwback crime thriller set in the mean streets of LA. It's based on a novella by Don Winslow, and Chris Hemsworth, Thor himself, plays Mike Davis, and he's a jewel thief who has many, many rules to what he does. He's very professional. He leaves no evidence, but crucially, he doesn't hurt anyone either. He's a very, very serious professional. Takes his job very, very seriously, like us. He's working on a series of heists alongside the 101, which is the Pacific Coast Highway. So this isn't like...
driven on it many times.
Right, so have I. So it's like, it's Crime 101. It's not like the beginner's guide to crime. It is crime on the 101, right? So it's geographical. And he is being hunted by Lou Lubeznik, played by Mark Ruffalo, aka the Hulk. And he's oh, good a Lord. Police officer who has put together the idea that all of these crimes are being pulled off by one guy. And it's his MO that he's very meticulous and he doesn't kill anyone. So he has a hunch. And God damn it, he will follow that hunch through. meanwhile, good old Mike has his eyes on a final score to get out of the business for good. And then, of course, he meets a lady played by Monica Barbaro and falls in love. But still plans to pull off his final heist. And he involves an insurance broker called Sharon Colvin, played by Halle Berry. And wouldn't you know...
A.K.A. Storm.
Indeed.
Or Catwoman.
And Shifty Barry's in the wings.
Shifty Barry?
Waiting to mix things up as well. So, you know, there's a lot going on here.
And his character from Eternals.
And his character from the Eternals.
Whose name we all know.
We all know it and we shouldn't say it.
We shouldn't say it. Even though we all know it.
We aren't,
That's absolutely right.
We're so familiar with it.
It's, look, if I was an absolute hack, I'd call this Reheat or something like that. Because it does...
Hang on. You are an absolute...
God damn it, you're right. This is Reheat. It's Michael Mann Light. It's a little bit like that. It wants to be that. And do you know what? So on the one hand, it's incredibly slick. The cinematography is beautiful. And it starts with this incredible inverted nighttime shot of the LA sort of freeway system. It's just stunning. It sounds really reductive, but it's like a proper grown-up film. Mm, and we don't get many of those. And that's actually quite delightful. It makes you think you're in the cinema back in the 90s again, which is, you know, fun. So that's really good. I actually really enjoyed some of the performances of this. Halle Berry in particular, I think, is great. Shifty Barry is great in all things, but in this in particular, he doesn't have another name. That is literally just his name.
Good Lord.
This is 2 hours and 20 minutes. So it is Crime 140, not Crime 101.
Very good.
Is it a little too long? Maybe. But I think there's only for one reason. And I think the heist in this, and it's not an action-heavy film. They don't throw in car chases, although there is a really good motorbike chase in it. But they don't throw in action sequences for the sake of it, because that's not what this is about. It's trying to get into the psychology of it all, and it's trying to lean into the character in the same way that he does. And this is my only issue with this film. I felt like the character work was too light. It was too shallow. It was too skin deep. And I felt like I never really knew these characters. And I think you can get away with it with Hemsworth's character, Mike, because he's supposed to be a little bit of a mystery man. He doesn't really talk about his past. He's quite, you know, you're not supposed to really get into his head. But I didn't buy Mark Ruffalo's character either.
What?
I really didn't.
You fool.
All of them I just thought were just a little bit thinly sketched. And I wanted to feel their motivations. I wanted to get them. And really, I was projecting fucking Ruffalo's character from Task onto him in this, because it's basically the same character. Generally speaking, even though Hannah and Macaulay, these two are not, it's a lot of fun sort of going backwards and forwards between this kind of cat and mouse thing. And like I say, it's a proper grown-up thriller type film, and it's pretty good. It's pretty good. Ben Travis, lover of all things, gave this 3 stars. Helen,
that's,
I think,
low.
Would go higher.
I think that's low. I think that's a little harsh. I had a really good time with this, and I was not hyped going in. I was like, this should be no more than 101 minutes.
Oh,
what the
good.
Hell? I'm here for an extra 39. I was not pleased sitting in the cinema, and yet I had a great time. And I think it is because it is a growing up thriller of the kind we don't get anymore. It's proper actors playing proper characters. I liked the way that the film kind of gradually and quite slowly actually wove them all together and how they eventually crossed paths. Because initially it's really not clear how these people are going to cross paths and if they're going to cross paths in some cases. And I really, really like the kind of slow build and the way that it set that up. I thought the love story with Monica Barbaro was going to be a little bit of a side issue and underserved. I think it was a little bit, but it ended up being more satisfying to me than I feared at one point in the film. I liked that Chris Hemsworth was trying to play a man with no game.
he God was doing it him. So badly.
No, I thought he did a good job.
He's a bit shy.
But he's like, you know, he's got trauma in his past.
He
he's
looks
got
like
lots
Thor.
Of,
yes. Even handsome men can be shy, James.
So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Mark Ruffalo trying to do yoga. I enjoyed the film's attempts to convince us that Mark Ruffalo is not sexy, several of us agreed.
You know, that was Pedro Pascal originally playing the Ruffalo role.
That also would have worked.
Yeah. It would have worked.
Yeah.
We all came out of the screen and we were like, they keep trying to tell us that Mark Ruffalo isn't sexy. Did you see him sat without a shirt on just then? Did you see him?
Anyway, so I just thought everybody was like doing good stuff. I had a really nice time. I
competence porn, right? Hell's
it
bells.
It is competence porn, but it's like really well. And if you're going to try and be another movie, try and be Heat. Yeah. I mean, that's a good, you know, don't try and be like Van Helsing. Try and be like a good movie. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know why that's the one that came to mind.
That was quite the ones we're pulling on.
I don't know why that's what came
to mind. Good advice.
So, yeah, I had a lovely time.
Yes. I agree with everything. I've upbraided Ben to his face in the office for giving us 3. I think it's incredibly harsh. This is, you know, I'm a sucker for a great crime thriller, and I think this is a great crime thriller. I think we've eaten well this year with this and The Rip, and Bart Layton is a guy who doesn't direct a lot of movies. It's been a few years since American Animals, which was his last film, and before that was The Imposter. Mm-hmm. So he's like the he's like Pennywise. He sleeps for 27 years and then he wakes up and he makes a film, whereas Pennywise just rips the arms off children. Anyway.
It
wasn't the greatest analogy, I'll be honest. But anyway, I thought this was terrific. Really, really great characters. Character work as well from the cast. And I thought it was genuinely tense and unpredictable.
Agreed.
When it brings certain characters together in certain situations. I was on the edge of my seat. I wasn't sure who was going to walk away from certain encounters. I thought it was terrific. I would give this 4, but Ben, who loves all films, has decided that this is a 3-star film. So you want to shout
at someone? Maverick is Ben, isn't he?
Shouted Ben.
Shame.
Shame. Shame on Ben. 3 stars in for Crime 101. Hellspells.
Hello.
Carn Hardy has returned with Whistle. You know how to review Whistle, don't you?
Just put your lips together and say, hey, this was fun.
Great. 3 stars in.
this is Daphne Keene starring as a girl who's just moved to town, strikes up a friendship with Sophie and Lisa's character, and becomes part of a bunch of, you know, young people at her high school. This is a high school set horror. And then she discovers this. Well, it's an Aztec death whistle.
There's no getting around it.
There's no getting around it. And you know what they decide? They only decide to do. They decide to blow it.
Of course they do.
And you know what's going to happen? They're all going to die unless they can find a way to reverse the curse. Now,
reverse the curse. They do it with rhyme because that would be amazing.
This has a good supporting cast as well. I just want to mention that, like, Michelle Fairley is in there, Nick Frost is in there. There's some like nice people that you know and like, as well as obviously the great Daphne Keene. I just really enjoyed this. So it's kind of got a Final Destination energy.
It Follows, maybe.
Yeah, a little bit of that. So it's kind of like your death is coming for you and it is going to find you and you're basically screwed. And I think that was kind of cool, and it made for some interesting depictions. Death doesn't look the same basically for everyone, as you'll sort of see when you see this. And I thought that was a really clever way of doing it. There was a little bit of plot armor in the sense that, like, you see one person's death early and then it takes a really long time for them to reach them, which didn't make a lot of sense to me, if I'm honest. But, you know, there were some things like that. I was like, I'm not sure what your rules are on a few things like that.
I think the rules are the movie has to be longer than 30 minutes.
I think that's it. But, like, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there was, you know, some deaths come very fast and some deaths, like, seem to really take their time.
I'm going to do a spoiler. In fact, I've done half a spoiler with Karin already, and that is what I'm going to ask. I'm going to ask about the rules and the order in which people are picked off. Weirdly, it's the order in which they appear on the credits.
What?
But the entity can't know that. It can't know who's number one on the call sheet.
Yeah.
So I have
a theory about the order, by the way.
Do you?
Yes, but I'm not going to say it because it would be a spoiler.
Do you? Yes. Oh, I'm intrigued. Spoiler special me.
But what I'm saying is, I still, like, that's my nit to pick, basically. But I did have a really good time with this because it feels like a throwback. It feels, like I say, very much rooted in, like, early Final Destination movies. And, in like, some of the energy between the group is quite Scream to me. It recalled Scream quite a lot. So it just felt like the sort of 90s, early noughties kind of a horror movie. And then, you know, there's lots of little references, not terribly hidden. I'm not giving anything away here, to even earlier horror, like Corin basically shouts out a lot of his favorite directors in little ways throughout the film, which I quite enjoyed because I'm a nerd. So I just had a good time. I thought it was fun. I don't think it's going to like change the world. I think it's a very kind of traditional, you know, horror movie, but I had a nice time watching it.
We'll say it has some spectacular kills.
Oh my God. So one of them in particular, I genuinely couldn't watch.
Really?
Yeah, there was one I had to look away from. It. I was like,
Mime it at me.
I go.
Yes.
Oh, that one. Oh, yeah, it was awful.
Yeah. It was so drawn out. You're like, oh
God.
Just no.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Yeah. I really
watch
liked
one on the podcast that as well, so that's good. It's really gnarly, like really gnarly. But as you say, it's quite traditional in its setup. I thought it was interesting the way it is very much confined to this high school. It's very school set. It's also worth noting there is a mid-credits scene.
Yeah, definitely.
That you'll want to watch.
Stick around for that.
Yes.
Stick around.
Yeah.
Stick around.
It's a lot of fun.
Vibe-wise, reminded me quite a lot of Smile as well. Yeah. But definitely with that, like if Crime 101 is the kind of 90s style crime thriller, this whistle is very much the kind of, late 90s, early noughties, like horror throwback. But in a way that doesn't feel really cynical and just trying to play into nostalgia, it feels like Corin Hardy is actually paying homage to it. And it felt authentic.
Because the kids feel quite now. Mm-hmm. Like they don't, you know, they feel quite like woke, frankly, compared to their predecessors in the 90s and early noughties.
That's true. But just the style of the filmmaking, I had a great time, really liked it.
Yeah, same here. Karin, of course, is a friend of the podcast, so I should recuse myself from talking about this, but I had a great time with it. I think it's really, really stylishly directed as well, and some of those kill scenes are worth the price of admission alone. I hope, because I know it didn't do that brilliantly at the US box office over the weekend, but I hope that it makes enough of an impact when it hits streaming, etc., that, you know, this could become a bit of a franchise.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, this is a more serious movie than I think, you know, when you're saying Final Destination, we all think about how that franchise essentially became a comedy. Nightmare on Elm Street became a comedy as it went on. But the initial episodes, the initial entries in those franchises were very, very serious and tonally very, very dark. And I think this echoes that very much so. Yep, I had a really good time with it. We gave this one 3 stars in for Whistle. Finally, Hell's Bells, the President's Cake sounds delicious.
You might think so. You might think, oh, a film about cake, what could be more delicious
and who doesn't love presidents
than that? Well, quite a few people these days. But this is a film written and directed by Hassan Hadi, and it is set in Iraq in 1990. So this is a time when, obviously, there were sanctions against Iraq. The Iraq invasion of Kuwait had happened. The Iraq war was kind of, you know, gearing up.
Saddam was still a thing.
Saddam was very much still a thing. To the point where the people of the country were mandated to celebrate his birthday.
He's the president of the president's cake, in case that hadn't become obvious.
Yes. Okay. He is the titular president. And so our heroine, Lamia, who is played by Baneen Ahmad Nayef, who is a just fantastic performance, just incredible character, loved her to death, who lives on basically kind of like a swampland, like a marshland in a hut with her bibi, her granny, played by Waheed Thabet Krabat. I apologize for my pronunciations. She is, you know, her name is drawn out of a hat in her class at school to bake the president's cake. And this is a massive crisis because they do not have the money to bake a cake. They do not. But failing to do so is literally pretty much a crime, or will certainly lead to them being...
They have a teacher who will dob them in.
They have a teacher who will dob them into the regime for failing to celebrate the president's birthday. Yeah. So this kind of sets off a sort of odyssey where she's basically sent into the big city to try and find the ingredients to make a cake. And of course, like, inflation is running riot, you know, shortages are everywhere. There are some good people who help them. There are also some very bad people who will not help them. And it is kind of an odyssey to make a cake, to find sugar and flour and butter and everything else.
It sounds like a really cute idea for a video game that you play in like 40 minutes on your mobile.
You would think it is cute. It is not.
It's not cute.
It's not a cute film.
No.
I find the basic premise very stressful because they are just, you know, they're in poverty, and this is a huge, essentially existential crisis for this little family unit. First of all, there is the genuine and very real threat of criminal sanctions if they fail to in this ridiculous task, And also, you know, they are sort of alone in a big bad world that is not out to get them specifically, but might just hurt them along the way. So it's quite a tough watch. But like, again, Lamia as a character is just so wonderful. I loved her so much. I wanted nothing but good things for her. And I was incredibly invested in her journey. So that's, I guess, what kind of gets you through. That's what you have to focus on in this film. So it's pretty heartbreaking. I'm going to be honest with you. It is pretty heartbreaking. It's beautifully made. It's incredibly well performed. Just great, great child performances, particularly from Nayef as Lamia.
For kid performances. Seriously, like non-professional actors. Whether it was my father's shadow last week or Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. I can never say the title of that film. And now this as well.
And Wuthering Heights as well. And I just want to shout out as well Sajjad Maham Kasim as Saeed, her friend who kind of helps her out. They're both fantastic.
Yeah.
It is pretty wonderful, but it is a tough watch. I'm not going to lie about that.
Mm.
I don't know what we've given it. It feels to me like an easy four.
Yeah.
Nuts. Four? Yeah, I think
it's been three stars for everything else this week. Let's go four.
Four candles.
Yeah, I mean, look.
What? On the cake?
I understand what you're saying, James.
Nothing but modern, up-to-date references on the Empire podcast.
Wow.
It's just, you know, I don't want to make light of the cake, all right? The cake is a big deal, so that's all I'm saying.
Cake is a made-up drug. Cake affects the part of the brain known as Shatner's bazoon.
I'll talk about topical references.
Yeah, that's true. But mine was a little bit more up-to-date than your two Ronnies was. But okay. Anyway, we gave this one
four stars.
Four Helen stars. I would concur with that. I think this is an absolutely terrific movie. Go and seek it out if you can in, I'm guessing, mostly art house plexes around the President's Cake. Four stars then for that. And anyway, on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by Wagner Moura and Kleber Mandonka Filho, who are the star and badly pronounced director of, respectively, The Secret Agent, which is the big Brazilian bombshell that's threatening the Oscars. So very, very excited about that. And there will be other people on the in the interviews as well. We'll be doing an episode of the interviews. I don't think there's one this week, but next week there will be. So keep them peeled for that. It's going to be very, very exciting indeed. But anyway, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye and happy Valentine's Day and happy Friday the 13th to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Sadly, those two will never meet, will they? Friday the 13th and Valentine's Day. They just seem set in their ways, destined to never meet, like ships in the night.
I don't know. You could watch My Bloody Valentine.
You could there watch
you
that.
Go. You could watch Valentine, which has got Angel out of the Buffy the Vampire Slayer in it.
And doesn't My Bloody Valentine remake have Dean out of Supernatural in it?
Maybe. Oh. I know it's in 3D. Important.
The Friday the 13th remake has Dean or Sam.
Oh my goodness, it's all coming together.
It's all coming together. But anyway, goodbye to James Dyer.
Goodbye. Please listen to my slutty little podcast.
Please listen to either on this or any other multiverse you care to name. Goodbye to Becky Dark.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Goodbye to Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo. And it's goodbye from me. I am off to win a date with Tad Hamilton, and this time I'm not letting him go. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.